Ladies and gentlemen, it's a privilege to begin the second day of the legislative session in celebration of the independent judiciary. We are honored, not only as citizens, but for those of us who've been blessed to live in other countries, it is a rarity to have a truly independent judiciary. Our judiciary is represented under the unified judicial system led by our Chief Justice, David Gilbertson. Chief Justice Gilbertson was appointed in 1995 after a distinguished career as an individual practitioner and a circuit court judge. And at that same time, he has been recommended by various organizations to that appointment by then Governor Janklow. Chief Justice Gilbertson is serving an unprecedented fourth term as the Chief Justice. As a man who loves South Dakota, who loves independent judiciary, and is concerned about the rule of law, he's pledged his life to that. He's been recognized nationally by the State Council of Courts for an award for the independence of the judiciary. It is an honor to have him come and speak in front of all of us. Sergeant at Arms, would you please announce the presence of our Chief Justice, please, sir?
Lieutenant Governor and members of the legislature, the Honorable Chief Justice of the South Dakota Supreme Court, David Gilbertson.
Thank you for that warm welcome. Governor Dugard, Lieutenant Governor Michaels, Speaker Gosch, members of the legislature, constitutional officers, my fellow justices, judges, and all citizens of the state of South Dakota. This marks the 12th year I have been privileged to come before you to present the state of the judiciary. In reviewing past messages, I noticed I discussed problems facing the unified judicial system and the state of South Dakota and suggested solutions to solve these problems. This year, however, I am delighted to present a message to you which focuses on programs already authorized and undertaking remedies to solve these problems. At least one nears completion. Others are just getting started. As Churchill said, it's not the beginning of the end, but it is the end of the beginning. This shows that when the three branches of government partner together to address a problem, progress towards resolving that problem happens. A retired judge friend of mine was fond of saying we're all in life's rowboat. If we row together, the boat moves forward. However, if we row at our own pace or not in sync with others, no matter how hard we row, the boat goes in circles or it goes nowhere. In life, we have a lot of options. Options broaden our opportunities. However, options do not amount to anything without some type of decision and action. If we arrive at the end of our term in office or at the end of our life with nothing accomplished, the options are still there, just being options. Alternative sentencing, veterans courts, the Rural Attorney Recruitment Program, along with the Odyssey software upgrade, now possess statutory authorization. However, the legislation passed last year is only a map to a goal. It's not the goal itself. The goal will be achieved only by successful implementation of those statutes. That is our challenge. Over the years, I've discussed the subject of alternative sentencing more than any other subject. This is because of its importance. Just a week ago, the largest newspaper in the state had as its front page headline the disappointing fact that South Dakota from 2007 to 2012 led the 50 states with the highest increase in crime, that being 20%. This is also a major cause for concern, as the article also pointed out that in 45 of the 50 states, there was no increase in crime at all. There was a decrease. At the same time, this state was tied with another state for fourth in the largest increase in prison population, that being 5%. These numbers present a clear validation that more persons in prison does not equal less crime outside them. In 2013, however, we turned the corner with the passage of Senate Bill 70, the Criminal Justice Initiative. Overwhelming legislative and public support, together with adequate funding, got the process off and running. Since passage, the UJS has moved forward with its obligations under the bill and has adopted rules of implementation. On July 1st, 2013, the Criminal Justice Initiative went into effect, and we started to look at potential sites to expand the drug court and alcohol court programs. It takes about 2 years to select a city, gain local, community, and public official support, and train staff. We are also looking at expanding existing programs in the Sioux Falls and Black Hills areas. The rural areas that lack counseling and other professional services, we have decided to pilot what we call a HOPE program, which comes from Hawaii. This program aims to reduce probation violations by drug offenders and others at high risk of recidivism. Pilot programs are planned for the Selby and Sioux Falls areas. These programs are not a get-out-of-jail-free card. The focus has changed from imprisoning nonviolent felons to giving each felon with addictions the personal responsibility to be in charge of his or her destiny. The felon is literally walking around with the key to the penitentiary in his or her pocket, and that felon decides by his or her conduct whether that key gets used. As the governor declared last year, we as a state need to be not only tough on crime, we need to be smart on crime and tough on criminal justice spending. The Criminal Justice Initiative puts the state on a path that espouses our traditional conservative principles of personal responsibility by the perpetrator and limited government and fiscal restraint by the state. Since its inception as an experimental program in 2008 in the Northern Hills, the drug and alcohol programs have shown a steady increase in clients served. As of January 1, 2013, approximately a year ago, there were 68 persons in our programs. The passage of Senate Bill 70 will obviously significantly increase that amount as more programs come into being and expand. As of January 1, 2014, a year later, there were 103 persons in our programs. So in 1 year, we increased from 68 to 103. That is 103 persons who, but for these programs, would have been in the state penitentiary at taxpayer expense, and experience tells us are more likely to return than not. Another important component of the Criminal Justice Initiative is the use of the Veterans Court concept. People are involved in drug and alcohol courts, and these folks have pled guilty to felonies and are under a suspended sentence to the penitentiary. Although the data is incomplete, it indicates that veterans who come into our legal system oftentimes stand accused of misdemeanors and not felonies. In cases where the judge, the prosecutor, and the defense attorney deem it appropriate, the veteran may be directly diverted to a rehabilitation program with the Veterans Administration, with the option that the misdemeanor charge will be dismissed if the veteran successfully completes the program. This is a significant advantage to the veteran because he or she will not have a criminal conviction if the program is successfully completed. Obviously, employers would rather hire a person without a criminal conviction than a person with one, even if the person is rehabilitated. We are moving forward with pilot projects on veterans courts in Sioux Falls, Watertown, and Hot Springs. The Annie E. Casey Foundation created the Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative, commonly known as JDAI, to work within the existing juvenile system to reduce juvenile detention, improve public safety, and save money. In many respects, JDAI mirrors what this legislature did with adult corrections with the passage of the Criminal Justice Initiative. In 2010, the Governor's Council of Juvenile Services and the Department of Corrections initiated JDAI in Minnehaha County and Pennington County. The results have been impressive. The use of a risk assessment instrument by JDAI coordinators in Minnehaha County has reduced the average daily population of juveniles in secure detention from 41 a day in 2009 down to 10 a day in 2012. This saved much of the daily cost of detention for Minnehaha County and made the discussion of the need for a larger and more expensive facility unnecessary. In Pennington County, the result was the same. The average daily population of juveniles in secure detention decreased from 23.5 per day in 2009 down to 9 per day in 2012. An additional benefit to the Department of Corrections during this period of time was a reduction of 42 post-adjudication youth commitments ordered by juvenile courts of this state. Given this success, the Unified Judicial System is working to make the benefits of this program statewide by achieving similar reductions in all areas of the state. If a law was passed evicting all attorneys from South Dakota's most rural counties, those being the 48 rural counties, universal outrage would follow. If a law was likewise passed forbidding new attorneys from locating in those 48 counties, there would be more justifiable outrage. The reaction would be, in large part, from the result. No access to legal services in these counties. Yet, prior to the passage of House Bill 1096, time and circumstances were well on their way to yielding the same result without the necessity of laws, guards, or barbed wire. I do not want to be the Chief Justice who, on my watch, is charged with permanently turning out the lights in the courtrooms of 48 courthouses because they are abandoned for lack of attorneys. President John F. Kennedy said, "Things do not happen. Things are made to happen." That is what occurred last year with the passage of House Bill 1096, the South Dakota Rural Attorney Initiative. The bill would not have been passed without the tireless leadership of Senator Mike Valley. More impressive than his leadership on the issue is Senator Valley's lack of connection to the legal profession. As we all know, he's a retired banker, and his residence is in Davison County, a county that stands to benefit nothing from this program. As Dr. Sammy Johnson once said, the true measure of a man is how he treats someone who can do him absolutely no good. The Rural Attorney Initiative allows the state of South Dakota to take a giant step forward to stem 50 years of decline in the ability of our citizens in rural areas to have reasonable access to legal services. I have observed that South Dakota is becoming a state with islands of justice provided by the larger cities and a sea of justice denied in rural areas. House Bill 1096 will hopefully reverse this trend. This law will help provide our citizens with access to an attorney and will work to ensure our rural county governments, our rural school districts, our rural cities and towns have access to legal services in those underserved areas. The South Dakota Association of County Commissioners is aware of the benefits of the Rural Attorney Initiative and the county's responsibilities should a county seek to participate. The association's initial response through its board of directors is enthusiastic. I've also met with the administration of the University of South Dakota School of Law and have spoken directly with many law students about this opportunity to receive assistance should they opt to set up a law practice in a rural area. South Dakota is the first state in the nation to undertake such a progressive response to overcome this problem. Perhaps the reaction outside of South Dakota is as strong an indication of the initiative's merit and creativity as is a reaction within South Dakota. It has drawn positive national interest because of every state in the country, well, I suppose the possible exception of Rhode Island and Delaware, they all have rural areas, so they're in the same situation. Your legislation was the topic of front page articles in the New York Times and the National Law Journal. CBS Radio also covered the issue on a national news broadcast. We plan for orderly growth in our state by zoning. We place special protection where needed, such as drug-free zones around schools. No parking zones protect access to fire hydrants for firemen. However, no one wants to see the growth of lawyer-free zones through benign neglect. House Bill 1096 will go a long way towards avoiding the growth of lawyer-free zones in South Dakota. Overlooked during the debates of the past year on the Criminal Justice Initiative and the cost of penitentiary incarceration are the quiet yet impressive results of the UJS probation program. There is no question that the number of inmates in the penitentiary has been increasing. At the same time, the number of individuals placed on felony probation by our circuit judges has also increased. The number for the past 4 years provides an interesting picture. Compare the number of people on probation who were sent to the penitentiary for a serious violation of probation with those who either successfully completed probation or remained on probation. For examples, in 2010, we had 4,824 people on felony probation in South Dakota. That year, 7% were violated and sent to the penitentiary. But 3 years later, 2013, we now have 5,892 people on probation, but only 4.4% were violated. So what does this tell us? The number of people sent to the penitentiary for probation violations dropped from 388 in 2010 to 260 in 2013, while the number of individuals on felony supervision increased by 1,000. Thus, while the number on probation significantly increased, we were able to reduce the number sent to the penitentiary for violations by a third. Given the cost of a penitentiary incarceration is around an average of $62 a day, cost of probation is only $3 a day. And our probation program provides a financial bargain in a program that works in appropriate cases. Not long after I became Chief Justice in 2001, I saw a demonstration of what you generically could call a two-way television system. Having burned up literally weeks of my yearly circuit judge time in windshield time and battling the all-too-frequent blizzards of northeast South Dakota, I decided to start a pilot project to determine the utility of such a system in our courthouses. The pilot project proved an immediate success and allowed access between judges, attorneys, and their clients, and law enforcement. A five-minute bond hearing with the use of this system cut down potentially hundreds of miles of travel preceding and following such a short but necessary hearing. The access for emergency matters needing the attention of a judge was also vastly improved. We moved toward and installed television units in about six counties per year. Along the way, we discovered the advantages of larger counties having a unit in the county jail and another unit in their courthouse. This system eliminated travel time, expense, and security risks between the two buildings. For minor hearings like bond hearings, the prisoner stayed in the jail and the judge stayed in the courthouse. By 2010, approximately half our courthouses enjoyed the benefits of this two-way television system. With the budget cuts of a couple years ago, we were forced to end the expansion of this program, although it continued to be highly successful where it existed. I am pleased to report to you that with improvements in technology, we can now purchase a smaller unit which will do the job for around $3,200 per unit as compared to $15,000 for an original unit purchase price. This will allow us to move forward with the installation of systems in 11 additional counties: Dual, Minor, Sanborn, Corson, Dewey, Zeebach, Campbell, Edmonds, McPherson, Millett, and Lyman counties will now be connected, and their citizens enjoy the advantages and financial tax savings of this system. Upon completion of this expansion, nearly every courthouse in the state will be connected with the system. Such a blizzard-proof system is preferable to the hands-on thrill of sliding into the ditch, which I experienced on more than one occasion in my circuit judge days. The Odyssey program is a paperless filing system in the circuit and magistrate courts, and it's well on its way to completion and success. The UJS has now converted every judicial circuit from a paper filing system to a paperless Odyssey system. As we move forward, we anticipate a day when electronic filing is a reality and court records can be viewed online. We are already experimenting with this in the Seventh Circuit, which is the Rapid City area. The UJS has worked for years to assure the program's success. In future years, I look forward to standing before you with the good news that the program is fully and successfully implemented. Once full implementation is achieved, the Supreme Court's records need to be converted into a paperless format. While Odyssey currently deals with the circuit and magistrate courts, the same format will be needed at the Supreme Court level to assure the same high level of service to the bar and the public. One of my enjoyable duties as Chief Justice is to visit with students of various ages and explain to them how the Supreme Court works. When talking to a group of third graders from Madison several years ago, one observed, "Your job doesn't sound like much fun. What do you do for fun in your job?" Well, I now have an answer. We are on a hunt to discover the original beauty of the Supreme Court's Law Library. The Law Library is open to the public and is probably the last remaining portion of this gorgeous Capitol building, which has not been restored to its original beauty. The reason was simple. We needed the shelving for the ever-increasing amount of law books we received. Now, with the advent of computerized legal research, the need for physical books is reduced, and we can consider decreasing the amount of shelf space in our law library. For years, we had heard rumors of a long-lost mural hidden behind the bookshelves. Imagine something of that beauty covered up by bookshelves. Anyway, with a little snooping on my part and with the aid of some hand tools, I removed shelving flush from the library wall and found original stenciling from 1911. We then brought in an expert painter who had worked on the original Capitol restoration decades ago. To our surprise, when he removed some paint, he found a word on the wall, and it was not a legal term. It gets better. A very astute staffer went and consulted Kingsbury's History of Dakota Territory and found it was the name of a territorial judge. And every 4 feet, the expert painter would take off the paint, and there was the name of another judge stenciled in large letters on the wall. We now have the names of 9 territorial and early state judges that have been found, and we believe more are concealed behind the bookshelves. We have a picture of how the law library looked the day it was opened in 1911, and we are working with the Bureau of Administration and the Capitol Restoration Commission on various options for restoration. Not all is what we suspected it would be, however. We found names of judges, we found stenciling, and we found other early memorabilia. But we discovered that the rumored long-lost mural never existed. I invite you to stop by our law library, which is on the second floor of the Capitol, just off the main rotunda, and see the hidden treasures for yourself. A restoration of that, what a fitting project for our state's 125th birthday. Another project I'd put in my fun category, I'm just full of fun today, comes from a gift of the Honorable William J. Cerska, who for 20 years searched for picture postcards of courthouses in South Dakota. When he retired in 2013, Judge Cerska donated his collection to the Supreme Court. The collection is complete and has at least one picture postcard of every county courthouse from every county in the state that's ever had one. While we have postcards of current courthouses, we also have postcards of 35 courthouses which at one time served the public but no longer stand. Some of them date back to territorial days. The collection itself of the pictures dates from about 1900 to the 1950s. Postcards are framed and mounted outside the doors of the Supreme Court's courtroom. This allows the public to see the pictorial history of their local county courthouse. I invite you to stop by and see what your courthouse looked like. To assure all areas of the state are represented on the South Dakota Supreme Court, current law requires that justices be residents of individual geographical districts. This year will mark the 20th and final year of Justice John Konenkamp's distinguished service to the citizens of South Dakota as a South Dakota Supreme Court Justice as he reaches the mandatory retirement age of 70. He is our lone justice from West River. I came onto the court a few months after him and have had the privilege of working with him throughout that time. I have never met a more dedicated public servant who has spent countless hours undertaking his judicial duties. There is no area of the court which has not benefited from his efforts. Legal scholars are well aware of his well-written and thoroughly researched opinions, which cover the entire range of legal subjects. In 2005, Justice Konenkamp became concerned that some South Dakota citizens were not being allowed to equally participate in our legal system. He convinced the Supreme Court to create the Equal Justice Commission, which he co-chaired along with Judge Pat Lee of the Ogallala Sioux Tribal Court. After holding hearings on every reservation in the state and elsewhere throughout South Dakota, the commission wrote a detailed report. All recommendations which fell within the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court were enacted and implemented the following year. An example of what was accomplished is a requirement that the South Dakota bar exam test on Indian law. At the time it was initiated, South Dakota was only the second state in the nation to do so. We continue that policy to assure the public new lawyers admitted to the South Dakota bar possess a working knowledge of Indian law. Justice Konenkamp was also a leading force behind the Odyssey Project, which I reported to you today, will bring our court records and filing into the 21st century and allow better access by the bar and the public. My father once said that it was a humbling thing to think that the world could have gotten along quite nicely without us if we'd never been born. He said it was the few, the very few, who have risen to the point where the world would have been a poorer place without them. Justice John Konenkamp is one of those very few. Given the requirement of the mandatory retirement law, we simply say to Justice Konenkamp a thank you for a superb job well done. Please help me recognize him. Leaders come and leaders go. Few leave lasting differences after they depart the scene. Judge Mildred Remyke, one of those who did make a monumental and permanent contribution, passed away this year at 95. It's unusual to call a person who was a 5-foot-tall individual a giant, but she stands as a giant in the South Dakota legal profession. Judge Remyke's list of accomplishments is impressive by any standard, but even more so when one considers all were accomplished as a first for a woman in our state's legal profession. When she graduated from the University of South Dakota School of Law in 1939, as only one of two women in her class, she became one of the few female attorneys in the state. She interrupted her legal career during World War II to serve her country. Instead of supportive tasks, which many women were relegated to during the war, she was a pilot of such skill, they wouldn't allow her to go into combat, but they would allow her to train the bomber pilots that did go into combat. After resuming her legal career, Judge Remyke became the first woman to serve as a district county judge, a circuit judge, a presiding circuit judge, and sit by designation with the South Dakota Supreme Court. She held these offices with a dignity and a fairness which is a hallmark for anyone who aspires to become a judge. She treated the town drunk with the same courtesy and fairness as a senior member of the bar. Today, 50% of the enrollment at our law school is female. There are 664 female members of the South Dakota State Bar. That is 1/3 of the entire membership of the state bar. 13 wear the robe of a judge, and one wears the robe of a justice. All owe a significant debt to this woman from Peaver, South Dakota, who paved the way. 2014 is an election year. You probably already know that. But, this year, a majority of the South Dakota Supreme Court justices will seek retention, and every circuit judge position is up for election. Judicial elections are different than partisan political elections held for the offices of the executive and legislative branches. At the Supreme Court level, the South Dakota Constitution calls for a justice to run on his or her record. A justice is literally voted up or down by the voters. At the circuit court level, a judge or judicial candidate runs on a nonpartisan election. This compromise was implemented when this state was still in its infancy. It allows for the election of the judges by the people, but keeps partisan politics out of judicial elections. Justice should not be rationed on the basis of partisan politics any more than on the basis of race, religion, or national origin. In order to ensure election rules are followed by judicial candidates, South Dakota is only one of two states which requires all judicial candidates, be they incumbents or challengers, to attend school on how to legally campaign for judicial office. South Dakota also has a nonpartisan committee of distinguished citizens to monitor judicial campaigns. The committee is chaired by the Honorable Robert A. Miller, the former Chief Justice of our Supreme Court. Any complaints found to be meritorious are promptly reported to the public through the press while the judicial campaign is still ongoing. Since this program was implemented, I am pleased to report that during the last two judicial elections, violations were few and far between. We do not consider judicial elections a game of gotcha. A judicial candidate may ask the committee for an advisory opinion as to whether certain conduct is permissible under the rules. Last week, the committee issued its first opinion, stating that it's permissible for a legislator to campaign for circuit judge, but cannot hold the two offices simultaneously. Copies of the opinions are made to the public so that other candidates in the public can also learn what the committee concluded. From time to time, I'm asked why judicial candidates do not take public positions on legal issues of the day, which rage in the public sector or in another court. The reason is that every person that comes into a court deserves to have his or her case heard by a neutral and a fair jurist who will decide the case on the facts presented in court and the existing statutory and constitutional law. How would you feel if you went into a court to protect your freedom or your property and you faced a judge who in the last campaign had made a point of publicly campaigning on the opposite side of your cause? Well, I suppose if the judge was biased in your favor, you might say it's not all that bad a deal. But remember, the pendulum on the clock goes back and forth, and history shows that the majority in power sooner or later becomes the minority, and the minority becomes the majority. A biased system would quickly lose credibility with the public. Who among us would tolerate a baseball umpire who called the pitch a ball or a strike before the pitch was even thrown? This does not mean that judges do not run on their record. In my home county during the 1930s, times were tough, and there was quite a crime wave of chickens being stolen from farmers. The local circuit judge had a policy that when the chicken thief was caught, the thief's sentence was 1 year in the penitentiary per chicken stolen. Simply put, stealing six chickens got you 6 years in the pen. The judge's justification for this rather harsh sentence was when the male farmer came to town to sell livestock, grain, cream, or milk, he got the money from the sale. The money received from the sale of eggs, by custom, however, went to the farm wife to purchase what she wanted for herself, such as a new dress. Obviously, a chicken stolen meant less egg money. Apparently, the sentencing policy found favor with the voters of the Fifth Circuit. The judge was continually reelected by handsome margins and ultimately died in office after a lengthy judicial career. Although there was no post-election polling in Roberts County in the 1930s, the old-timers told me that local wisdom had it, the judge did very well with the farm wife vote. When he passed away, He was so highly regarded, he is the only judge in the history of the county to be honored by lying in state in the rotunda of the county courthouse. Recidivism was also eliminated. During my 10-year tenure as a prosecutor, and later a 10-year tenure as a circuit judge in Roberts County, I was never once called to deal with a case of chicken thievery. History shows the path of the South Dakota judicial system is a long and winding road. However, it is in reality a path that never ends. Times and challenges change, and we must change to meet them. In 1787, this was not a country, but a collection of loose states. So loosely connected, it appeared the entire experiment in democracy might collapse into anarchy. In a last attempt to salvage the victory of the American Revolution, delegates met in Philadelphia. Disagreements between the states threatened this effort. Finally, through timely compromise, our Constitution was drafted. At the completion of this convention, Benjamin Franklin, then in his 80s, rose and commented on the chair occupied by George Washington, the convention chairperson. The chair contained a carving of a partial sun on the horizon. In reference to the fate of the new United States, Franklin had studied that carving of the sun throughout the convention and pondered whether that partial sun was a rising sun or a setting sun for the new country. With the drafting of the new Constitution, Franklin declared, "But now at length I have the happiness to know that it is a rising and not a setting sun." Franklin was correct. May we all strive to serve the people pursuant to our constitutional duties to ensure the sun of the United States and the sun of the state of South Dakota, the Sunshine State, continues to be a rising sun and not a setting sun. This is not a one-time effort. Each day requires we meet this obligation anew. Thank you. Thank you.